Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take Aim, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories that the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I am Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, joined today by my co-host Don Irvine, Accuracy in Media's chairman. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Roger.
How you doing?
Doing fine.
Okay. Well, we have another great show for today, and I want to introduce our first guest. We'll get right into it. He's on the line. We have Ken Boehm with us. Ken, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Terrific. Well, Ken is a co-founder and chairman of the National Legal Policy Center, a conservative government watchdog group that promotes ethics in public life through research, investigation, education, and legal action. And prior to the founding of the NLPC, the National Legal Policy Center, he served as counsel to the board of directors of the Legal Services Corporation, the federal program which ostensibly provides legal assistance to the poor. He has long been active in both legal and conservative organizations. Mr. Boehm's professional background includes service as a prosecutor, an administrative assistant to Congressman Christopher Smith, Republican of New Jersey, and as chairman of Citizens for Reagan. His Washington background includes service as legislative director of Howard Jarvis's American Tax Reduction Movement, as well as being treasurer of one of the 10 largest political action committees. Did I get it right, Ken?
That's entirely right.
Good, excellent. Well, first, I understand you have a bit of history with Accuracy in Media and AIM's founder, Reed Irvine.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, back in the 70s when I was going to law school in the evenings, I was very active with conservative groups, and Reed Irvine came to town for a speaking engagement, and I got the assignment to give him a ride and got a chance to drive around from one event to the other and talk with him, and after that became a regular subscriber and supporter and followed AIM really through the years. And people have got to remember that was back in the day before we had some of the media outlets we have now on cable and talk radio and that sort of thing. And he really was outnumbered, but time and again, truth is a powerful ally. He was able to skewer the liberal media with just truckloads of evidence of their bias and their failure to cover important news stories.
Great. Do you remember any particular stories that he did back at the time that got your attention?
Well, we're talking, this was back in the 70s, so
okay.
I can only imagine, knowing what the 70s were like with Jimmy Carter running the White House, the liberals running the House and the Senate, it was a time of economic malaise, to use Carter's phrase, and things were going bad on virtually every front, Iran and Nicaragua, just everywhere you looked, the liberal leadership that controlled the media, controlled the workings of Congress, etc., was making mistakes. And I think, though, the fact that there were good people then, and you'd mentioned I'd worked for Howard Jarvis, who won an incredible victory with Prop 13 out in California, and Reed Irvine with Accuracy in Media. And, of course, we had Ronald Reagan, who was going to be the nominee in 1980. And for those of us who lived, and I realize I'm dating myself for probably a lot of your listeners, but for those of us who lived through that period, you can't help but compare it to today. where, you know, the main media outlets are still controlled, New York Times, Washington Post, the three major networks and so forth, by the other side, and they control the White House and both houses of Congress. And the phrase, it's always darkest before the dawn, comes to mind because our side, even though we're outnumbered in virtually any public policy issue or debate politically and in the media, had the truth on our side. And we scored tremendous victories, and then in the end, Ronald Reagan won in a landslide, and communism fell, and the economy was turned around. We got tax cuts. I mean, if there's a lesson in this, the lesson should be fight for your principles, regardless of what the odds currently look like. We can't be wet finger to the wind types. We've got to stick to our original principles.
So what led you to create the National Legal Policy Center? I know you're a co-founder, so
Pete Flaherty and I looked around, and we saw that the groups that purported to be ethics watchdogs, Common Cause and groups like that, Naderite groups, groups that wanted to take away people's First Amendment rights in terms of political speech, really didn't do the job in terms of ethics and government. And so we launched National Legal and Policy Center in 1991, but our first big splash, if you will, was when the Clintons came in, and their big issue, look at what we're dealing with today, was the health care. And Hillary Clinton set up a secretive health care task force, hundreds of people on it, didn't allow the media or the public to know what was going on, and kept minutes secretly, did all kinds of things secretly, and our group and two others filed a lawsuit in federal court saying this violates federal law. Federal law says if you have people from the outside in one of these task force, then the public's entitled to see the documents and attend the meetings. And we won that lawsuit, and that helped break the momentum for Hillary Clinton's pushing through their version of nationalized health care back in 1993. And we ultimately not only won the lawsuit, but opened it up and saw in the hundreds of thousands of documents that the court ordered disclosed that the they were doing all sorts of mischief behind the scenes. They're sitting down with special interests, cutting secret deals. It's a little bit like what's going on now with the health care proposal that's being pushed by both the president and his allies in Congress.
Ken, this is Don Irvine.
Yeah, Don.
I don't want to go back and date myself too much on this, but I just, since you have a relationship or had a remembrance, recollection of meeting my father and everything like that, I'll put in a plug and say how I recall meeting Pete Flaherty for the first time when I was in college in the 80s, and he came out to meet with me about something when we were involved in Young Americans for Freedom back in the day. And I also seem to recall, too, that I think during that healthcare thing with Hillary Care, I think that Pete's brother had written a book on Hillary and healthcare, too.
Well, actually, Pete and his brother Tim co-authored the book on that. And We think it was the right thing to do at the right time because, as you recall, a lot of the Republican leaders in Congress felt that, we're going to be steamrolled on this. There's no way we can hold it back, so let's get some crumbs from the table. I mean, Senator Dole, who was very good in certain things on this, said, well, I guess we're going to get some kind of health care. And our point is, well, for starters, they're designing this thing in secret in violation of federal law. So why don't we take our stand there? And federal judge Royce Lamberth, and also it went up to federal appeal court. We won consistently, and it still took us a year and a half. But and we see that as the beginning of the turning around. And it was defeated then. And as you recall, not only was it defeated, but in 1994, Republicans won control of Congress for the first time in 40 years. And so that's why I say it's sometimes darkest before the dawn. If the other side is overreaching, which they're very prone to do, and the public can be informed as to here's what's going on and here's why it's wrong, wrong from a policy standpoint or even a legal standpoint, then I think ultimately we're in a position to win on the final issues.
Well, speaking of overreaching, your organization announced just the other day that found out that the White House, specifically at the Executive Office of the President, is looking for a private contractor to capture and archive comments and information posted on social networking sites like Twitter, Facebook, MySpace, where the White House maintains a presence. Can you explain this in a little more detail for me?
Sure. And Don, this is not in a vacuum. As we've seen just in the last 30 days or so, the very beginning of August, the head of White House New Media, a gentleman called by the name of Macon Phillips, put up on his White House site, report people who are spreading misinformation about the Obama healthcare plan. And it smacked of an enemies list. It smacked of people turning in people they didn't like and know. It wasn't something the White House had ever done. And there was such an outcry about it that they backed off. And they, we're not going to do that anymore. That was just a mistake. Sorry about that. Then in mid-August, Major Garrett over at Fox News had challenged him on the fact that a large number of people were getting spam email signed by David Axelrod, very senior White House staffer under who he was campaign manager for Obama. And they were getting emails from David Axelrod giving them all the reasons they should support Obama and the Democrats' health care plan. Well, you know, that's not something that should be going out of the White House. The DNC is free to do it. But running an operation like that, and they couldn't say that, well, these people signed up for these emails because too many people said, I've never signed up for anything at the White House. And in effect, it was a spam operation. And so they backed down on that. And the same group was responsible, the new media operation, which when you look at the people involved, there was a good article in Nation magazine, the left of center magazine, about the new media operation at the White House. These are people who came right out of the campaign, who worked in efforts at the grassroots with groups like Move On and other groups. And you don't have to wonder what kind of operation they're going to do. These aren't archivists. These aren't people who are really interested in presidential records. These are political types. And so what we found was on August 21st, the White House quietly put out a bid. They didn't put a dollar sign on it. They wanted tech vendors to come up with a pretty broad-scoped plan to harvest all kinds of information from White House, from internet sites, especially they pointed out social networking. Now, the rationale, and there's some legitimate purposes in this, but the rationale was, well, under Presidential Records Act, we have to keep things that are produced by the White House, and the White House does produce content that appears on YouTube and appears on Twitter and appears on MySpace and so forth. But they went much further. They said, we want to capture all comments posted. There could be people who are opposed, people who support, whatever, far beyond what's required by the Presidential Records Act. And we dug into it. In fact, we have a copy of the proposal posted to our webpage, www.nlpc.org. Anybody can read this thing. And at best, it's ambiguous. At worst, for the public interest, it's so broad-based that it looks like they're going to be harvesting all kinds of information. And they're kind of secretive about what they're going to do with it. And so secretive, for example, they say that the vendor who successfully gets this contract, which is going to be decided later this month, is forbidden to tell anybody they have the contract, which is a little unusual. That's not a usual requirement in a government contract solicitation. And they're not allowed to talk to the press or the media about what websites they're harvesting or how broad they're going or anything else they're doing. It's a total gag order, which is highly unusual in terms of this kind of government contract. The fact that they don't put a dollar figure on it is also unusual. I mean, usually if you're soliciting bids for a contract, you give them some idea of here's how much we want to spend. But in this case, there's not any, even a range or a cap. They say submit it, and then we'll discuss it. And they want to keep it as secret as possible. But as I say, there's all kinds of indicators that this thing is going to be gigantic. One of the requirements, for example, is that the vendor have 10 phone lines, 10 dedicated phone lines minimum, just to take additional website and URL information to be crawled by this computer operation. Who needs 10 lines if you're only going to do a handful of web pages, to add web pages? So the fact that it comes from the same shop that has already abused Internet technology and privacy rights and so forth for political purposes twice in the last month, the fact that it's so open-ended, the fact they won't put a dollar figure on it, the fact that this thing is so secretive, they even have a non-disclosure agreement where they threaten criminal penalties for disclosing certain information associated with this contract. That tells me they're up to no good, and they can rebut that by making everything open. The promise was that this would be the most transparent and accountable White House ever. And one of the things they do is to have this giant secretive data mining operation by, again, the same folks who have had to back away twice in the last 30 days from things that they did that were abusive. So I think if you step back, look at the big picture, this is another power grab, and I think ultimately they're going to have to back down on this like they did the other two issues.
Well, let me play a little bit of the devil's advocate in a sense.
Sure.
With the social networking sites of Twitter, you know, Facebook, MySpace, what kind of privacy rights should the public expect in that? And these are public networks as such.
None whatsoever. In terms of if you're going to post something up, you shouldn't. The real issue here isn't so much the privacy rights. The real issue is how much in taxpayer dollars is going to go for this, and what's the intended end use. If the intended end use is intelligence gathering, say there's a breaking issue, you know, a news story comes out, and they want to see what all the, you know, conservatives are saying about it versus what the liberals are saying about it, and maybe transfer that information over to Organizing for America, which is the tech operation at the Democratic National Committee, which took the 13 million email addresses that the Obama campaign had and did. If they're going to use it for something like that, that's over the line. The White House can do, obviously, certain things that are political. It can't do all sorts of other things that are political. It's not allowed to run a grassroots advocacy operation out of the White House using taxpayer funds. That's inappropriate. It's always been inappropriate. And so the real issue that we're making is not that capturing information itself is wrong. It's that the folks doing the capturing have had a very checkered track record. There is a legal argument, though, and the legal argument is this, that under the Privacy Act, while the government can keep personal records on you, me, and other people, assuming it's for a legitimate government purpose, they can't just release them willy-nilly to everybody. Ultimately, all presidential records, with the exception of things that are classified in terms of national security, are open to the public after the president has left office. And so one of the arguments made by some conservative and free market groups about the White House email address where people were supposed to report people who were spreading misinformation about their interpretation of misinformation about the White House health care plan. One of the points made, and these folks have filed a lawsuit, is that that violates the Privacy Act. You're going to have people running around complaining about people, not for any legal reason or legitimate reason, it's just they don't like their First Amendment rights. And I think ultimately it has a chilling effect. But I mentioned the other legal argument, though, is they're supposed to keep records that are generated by the White House staff, the executive office of the president's staff, if some individuals, conservatives or liberals, post all sorts of comments to hundreds or even thousands or tens of thousands of web pages, there's not an expectation of privacy, but there's also no legitimate government purpose to harvest and sort and set up a database of that information. That's something they're welcome to do at the DNC. It's not something they should be using the White House budget for.
One other thing, Ken, that you, I understand you're planning to file a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act request, about how they're planning to keep this secret?
Well, the White House itself is not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. Freedom of Information Act is, you know, very user-friendly. Anybody can file it to get any document in the government, assuming that the document isn't under one of nine exemptions. It's not a national secret. It's not personal information, etc. And while you can't file a FOIA request for the White House, you can file a FOIA request for documents for the GSA, General Services Administration, which is the entity that's actually administering this contract. And so I think, despite all of their claims in the solicitation that this is going to be secret and the vendor can't tell anybody and we're not going to say how much the dollar figure is, I think they totally misunderstood the records law, because once that contract is let, we're going to file a Freedom of Information Act request. And there's no exemption I can think of that would stop disclosure, and we won't be filing it with the White House. We'll be filing it with the GSA. And that will happen later this month. I'm sure they'll drag their feet a little bit, but when that comes out, we intend to post it on the Internet, because the public's entitled to know what happens with their tax dollars.
Well, let's move on to a couple of other topics that that the NLPC covers. And one is that you've been leading the investigation, and the tracking is Charlie Rangel, the powerful chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. On your website, it says, by our count, Rangel simultaneously claimed three primary residences. The first is where he really lives, in three rent-stabilized Harlem apartments for which he doesn't qualify based on his income, and that the NLPC is filing a complaint with the Federal Election Commission alleging that he violated election law. So tell us, is this as blatant corruption as it seems, or what's going on here?
All kinds of violations of the law, all kinds of tax violations, but on the residences, he actually had four what they call rent stabilized. People who live in the New York City area know what it means. It's like rent controlled apartments. They have a very strict upper income level, and if you throw in the amount of money he now admits he was making, because he filed a lot of amendments to his past financial disclosure reports, he wasn't even qualified to have any of those four units. But one of the units was being paid for and used by Rangel for Congress, his congressional campaign, and a political action committee, National Leadership PAC, that he uses to give money to other candidates. And because his landlord is a corporation, and because a rent-stabilized unit gives you a 50% break on the price, that's tantamount to a corporation giving a 50% break to a federal campaign, which is illegal as all get. It's been illegal since like 1908. And so we filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission saying, look, not only is he unqualified to be living there, but that's not a FEC issue. That's an issue for New York. But the fact that his campaign is getting 50% reduced rent from a corporation, a corporation whose major supporters back him politically, give him money and so forth, means that over a period of over 10 years, he got a break in the six figures in the form of illegal corporate contributions through these discounts. So that was the point we made there. But then we went one further. We looked through his financial disclosure reports, and we saw for a long period of time he owned a beach villa in Punta Cana, which is in Dominican Republic. He never put the address, as he was required to do. You're supposed to have an identifiable address, as if you could send mail to it, for example. And so we had an attorney who happened to be my nephew, who speaks fluent Spanish, lives in Puerto Rico, has sold real estate in Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, go there and find his beach villa and talk to the people there. And we found out his beach villa was right on the beach, and that it was fully rented, and that he made in the neighborhood of $150,000 a year in rental income. And if you look at his financial disclosure report, it showed hardly anything. Some years, nothing. We gave the information to the New York Post. They ran a front page story. Rangel happened to be down there when they were there with the reporter and photographers. So there's a picture of him in a Chase lounge taking a snooze. But the big issue was that he was getting rental income under the table for a long period of time. Now, he denied it vociferously for about a week. He hired a lawyer, Lanny Davis, the lawyer who did damage control for the Clintons during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and he said, well, it looks like we overlooked $75,000 in income, so we're going to pay the IRS what we owe. Our position is just do the math. That thing rents very expensively, and it's booked solid for the entire season, November through May. And so we think that's just the tip of the iceberg. That helped get him in trouble with the ethics committee. We also, Peter Flaherty, who you mentioned before, went on a junket to the Caribbean, where Charlie Rangel and a number of other congressmen, Democratic congressmen all, were going. It was paid for by some corporations, including Citicorp, which had gotten in excess of $20 billion in bailout money. And the House rules, the rules that Nancy Pelosi passed, said that corporations that hire lobbyists are not allowed to sponsor multi-day trips for congressmen. Well, this was a multi-day trip.
So let me ask, we've just got a few minutes left with you here, but I noticed the latest thing, he failed to report some $600,000 in assets in a financial disclosure form. So what is likely to happen? Is it because the Democrats control Congress, he's going to get away with this, or do you think they're going to pressure him to step down? Is he going to face any criminal or ethical issues, complaints here? What's going to happen?
Well, it's before the Ethics Committee, but the Ethics Committee is equally divided between Republicans and Democrats. And when it comes to ethics issues, very rarely do they take action because it means somebody has to cross party lines. And that doesn't happen. And three of the five Democrats have received contributions, large contributions from Rangel, which you would think would disqualify him, but hasn't. I think what's going to happen is, and the Washington Post, of all newspapers today, called for Rangel to step down from Ways and Means Committee. New York Times has called for him to step down. Even liberal groups and liberal papers are saying this guy should not be overseeing our tax code since he's a tax cheat. And I think what will happen is Pelosi does not have the political oomph to remove him, and she's afraid to remove him because he'll counterattack. And so what's going to happen is they're going to be tarred with Charlie Rangel, tax cheat. She ran on a campaign, Democrats ran in 06, we've got to end the culture of corruption. Well, what's this if not corruption? And so I think what will happen is as next year comes around and lots of Democrats are looking at polls showing they're going to lose, they are going to press her to finally do what she should have done when all this ethical scandal surfaced, which is remove him as chairman of Ways and Means Committee.
But nothing like what happened to Congressman William Jefferson. You don't expect there to be any indictments out of this, huh?
As I used to be a prosecutor, I could write an indictment in my sleep in 5 minutes. If you don't declare income, we don't know what's on his income tax, but presumably what was on his income tax is what he filed with the financial disclosure report, which does have perjury penalties on that too. If he put his income tax what he put there, then essentially he was not paying taxes on large sums of money, not for a year or two, but year after year after year, going back maybe 10 years or so. That's pretty serious. And if you or I tried that, we'd be in legal trouble. The IRS would be telling us we should, get a lawyer. He oversees the IRS. He not only writes the tax code, but his committee, Ways and Means, has the oversight responsibility for the Treasury Department and the IRS. And so, yeah, they could indict him today. Will they?
You're not suggesting the Obama administration's Justice Department is politicized, are you?
Well, a little, yeah. Yeah, I have a hard time seeing Holder going after him. But I think in the end, you know, there's only so much you can sweep under the rug before the rug's bumping up against the ceiling. And I think Rangel's problem is every month or so something new and something sizable surfaces. How long can that go on before it's just so totally indefensible that they're going to have to do what they should have done long ago, which is take action?
Well, let's touch on one more thing. Give us, I know you've been looking into the corruption in the stimulus funds, the bailout money,
right,
and the TARP funds. Give us a little wrap-up of what you found on that, and then we're going to have to let it go. But
sure.
Great having you here. Go ahead.
Well, just briefly, everybody knows that the $700 billion-plus was full of waste, fraud, and abuse. And it's actually $1.2 trillion if you count the interest on it. And it seems that not a day goes by you don't hear of more scandal, more waste, more abuse. They purposely put things in to frustrate any kind of oversight. They claimed they were going to have transparency. They haven't. And so our group, but a lot of other taxpayer groups and other groups, continue to monitor that. And when we find things, what we do is we report it to, there's a special inspector general for TARP, the Troubled Assets entity. And if it's money that comes from a particular department, defense, agriculture, interior, transportation, we also send that evidence to those inspector generals. So it's waste galore. It was designed to be waste. It was designed to be pork. There's so little stimulus in the stimulus that it's laughable. And this is our money. I mean, this is what's going to double the national debt. This is what our children and grandchildren are going to have to pay off. And so we think it's important that as many groups and individuals as possible take a long, hard look at what's happening to this money. In many cases, it's being used politically. In other cases, it's being used like earmarks are used. It's being used for special interests that politically support the party that pushed it through.
Well, Ken, it's been great having you here today, and we've really learned a lot from this. And then tell everyone again what the website is, how they can read more on all of this.
Sure. All of our work and material is up on the Internet. It's www.nlpc, for National Legal and Policy Center, nlpc.org.
Thank you so much, and hopefully we'll have you back again sometime.
Well, my pleasure, and thanks for all the good work you folks have been doing for so long.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now, our next guest is just joining us. We have Stephen Hayward. And Stephen, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Terrific. I can hear you, yes. This is Roger Aronoff and Don Irvine with Accuracy in Media, and we're happy to have you on here today. Stephen is with the American Enterprise Institute. He is the producer and host of An Inconvenient Truth or Convenient Fiction, which was a rebuttal to Al Gore's documentary. And he's been the author of many books on environmental topics and biographies. He's written biographies of Presidents Carter and Reagan and of Winston Churchill. He's also a senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute. So did I get it right there?
Yeah, I have way too many affiliations for even me to keep up with sometimes.
Okay. Well, listen, you've actually been working on Reagan for many years. This is your second volume at this time with the title The Age of Reagan. So start out, how do you define the age of Reagan?
Well, I borrow that title self-consciously from a famous title from a liberal author. Arthur Schlesinger, way back in the 50s, wrote a series of books called The Age of Roosevelt, arguing for the preeminence of Roosevelt in changing America's political culture. I thought it was worth returning the favor and making the case about how Ronald Reagan changed America's political culture, starting with his emergence in politics in the 60s and then, of course, culminating with his presidency, which still has important echoes for us today.
Great. Since Ted Kennedy recently died, I wanted to ask you about that, the relationship between Reagan and Kennedy. You quoted Kennedy in this new book as blasting Reagan for government by the rich and for the rich, and talked about his famous attack on Judge Bork,
right,
and preventing him from becoming a Supreme Court justice. So, and then people have recently been reminded in certain places about how Kennedy sent Senator John Tunney to the Soviet Union with a message that perhaps could have helped him win the 1984 election, could have helped Kennedy win it. So tell us about what you've discovered through your research about the relationship between those two.
Well, I mean, you hit the high points there. They didn't have much of a relationship. Remember that Kennedy was in the minority in the Senate for most of Reagan's presidency. And, you know, the guy that Reagan had to deal with more, well, of course, was Tip O'Neill. Now, I mean, he got along with Kennedy in the ordinary sense. They're both Irishmen, and they could both smile and laugh and all the rest of that. But Reagan mostly ignored Kennedy, truth be told. And, you know, Kennedy, you pointed out that very dubious episode where Kennedy sent John Tunney to Moscow, among other things, offering to arrange TV broadcast appearances for Yuri Andropov, who was running the country, running the Soviet Union at that time, just barely, because he was very sick. And that is a very dubious thing. You know, Kennedy didn't decide not to run for president until, I think, either late 1982 or early 1983, but still held open that he might yet run anyway if Reagan looked weak or if the Democrats didn't have anybody else. Yeah, that's you know, it's an interesting story. You know, people forget in all the gauziness with which we view the passing of any prominent person, they forget that the Kennedys were always bare-knuckled, sharp-elbowed operators. And so, you know, Kennedy playing off the Soviet Union against Reagan was very much of the kind of thing that his two brothers would have done, or that his dad did to help his brother John F. Kennedy get elected way back in 1960. So, you know, we forget that for all their liberal pieties, these guys were sharp operators.
This is Don Irvine, Steve.
Hi, Don.
How you doing?
Good.
What about Reagan and the media? It's often commented how Reagan went above or around the media and spoke directly to the people that they're the ones who believed and trusted in him.
Yeah.
Could you characterize how Reagan communicated his ideas in an environment of a hostile media?
Well, most of the time, Reagan conducted his whole political career this way, but most of the time, Reagan understood that the best defense was an offense. He didn't give ground on his principles, and he would sort of charge right back at the media when they'd, I quote in the book some of his leading questions, like, you know, what do you say to someone who's losing their welfare benefits, or, you know, other questions motivated by a leftist agenda. And of course, the other thing he would do is, use humor. I repeat the episode in the book about how one day in 1982 at a press conference, Sam Donaldson, the human foghorn, as I call him, stands up and in his full pompous way says, "Mr. President, you blame Democrats for the deficits. Do you take any blame yourself for the large deficit?" And Reagan said, "Well, yes, Sam, I do, because after all, for a long time, I was a Democrat." That's the way to handle the media, you know, a little bit of humor and turning it back on them.
Well, how does the liberal media now view Reagan? I had the impression during the time of his death that he was actually being held up as someone to be admired, largely to suggest that Reagan was a principled conservative.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a couple of points to be made about that, and it's why part of the reasons I wanted to write the large-scale book that I did. First of all, there's something that I've noticed about liberals for a while now is they always like conservatives who are dead, or in the past. So, I mean, remember that, you know, liberals always hated Ronald Reagan. They always hated William F. Buckley. And yet now you have people like Sam Tannenhaus at the New York Times saying, gosh, if only the conservative movement today were more like it was when William F. Buckley was around. Well, this is just a classic bait and switch is what's going on. Why can't George W. Bush be more like Ronald Reagan, forgetting that liberals hated Reagan when he was president and so forth? So I try to recapture in the book that the liberal hatred and opposition to Reagan was just as ferocious as it was, say, to George W. Bush the last few years, and that, you know, once again, we're letting nostalgia cloud our clear perception of how things went down. But there's a second part of the story, which is a lot of liberals started to like Reagan starting about 10 years ago, mostly because of the Cold War story and the fact that Reagan, brought the Cold War to an end, and the documents came out, and they realized how subtle his diplomacy was. However, what they always do is they make a distinction between Reagan's foreign policy and his domestic policy. And so they say, well, Reagan was great on foreign policy, but his domestic policy was terrible, as we all know. And so I try to refute that idea and show that his domestic policy and foreign policy need to be understood together. I mean, Reagan thought that big government was the problem in all its forms, whether it's mindless bureaucracy here at home or whether it's totalitarians behind the Iron Curtain. And so I try to restore the unity of Reagan's statecraft. The other thing they do is they try to argue that Reagan, there were two Reagans. There was the first term Reagan of the evil empire and the second term Reagan who was conciliatory and made deals with Gorbachev. And I argue that that interpretation is also quite wrong. In fact, that the Reagan of the evil empire lasted all the way up to the end and beyond, and I've got the quotations from him and from his writings to prove it. And also that Reagan was his own good cop, bad cop. He understood that he could make deals, but only so long as he was very tough in his first term, and that it almost unfolded exactly the way he planned it out and foresaw it. So the liberals are up to mischief when they do this. They're trying to recreate Reagan somewhat in their own image, and I'm trying to keep them from getting away with that.
So you brought up the Cold War. How significant do you view Reagan's role in defeating the Soviet Empire? You write that many of his advisors actually advised him against his Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall speech, but he was determined to make it anyway.
Right. That's not the only one. A lot of people didn't want him to use the evil empire phrase. A lot of people did not want him to give the Strategic Defense Initiative speech. He was almost alone in both of those speeches in insisting that he was going to say it. Even a lot of Soviets have said afterwards that Reagan, in general, but in particular the Strategic Defense Initiative, hastened the demise of the Soviet Union by a decade or more. He really pressed us hard in ways that we were totally did not expect. There's been a lot of good books in that by conservatives, and I don't have a whole lot new except for a couple of little details. One of the things that Reagan did was to deliberately squeeze foreign hard currency earnings of the Soviet Union to really squeeze their economy and make the arms race more expensive for them, increase their cost of empire. And part of that was, he decontrolled oil prices here, and then, the world oil markets calmed down and the price of oil fell by more than half. Well, the Soviet Union got a lot of their money from selling oil. So there's this interesting moment in the Reykjavik summit that people have skipped over and missed, I think, where Reagan says to Gorbachev, so, how come you haven't lived up to your end of the bargain on the latest wheat deal that we had? Because we were selling them wheat a lot, and one of the reasons we sold them wheat is it cost them money, hard cash to buy our wheat, which is different than giving them money to, build pipelines and, cross-subsidize their military, which we'd done under detente. And Gorbachev says back to him, says, well, we're broke, is essentially what Gorbachev said. Oil prices have collapsed, and so we don't have any oil earnings coming in right now. And then Gorbachev says quite curiously, he says, and we know who started that, don't we? As though Gorbachev understood that the fall in oil prices had been a deliberate foreign policy tactic of Reagan to squeeze the Soviet Union. And I thought that's a part of the dialogue that's in one of the transcripts that everybody else has overlooked in reviewing the Reykjavik summit, because they usually go off on the other dramatic parts of that summit that happened later in that day.
And have you found evidence to support Gorbachev's suspicions there?
Well, it's a little murky, but one of the things that apparently we did, and there's some circumstantial evidence to this, is that we got a lot of the oil-producing nations, especially Saudi Arabia, to increase their output in the mid-'80s, precisely to drive down the price of oil because it would hurt the Soviet Union. There's no documents on that or so-called smoking guns, but we do have some secondhand accounts of CIA Director Casey making trips over there and so forth.
Well, it seems that while the CIA and other government branches felt that the Soviets were stronger economically than they turned out to be, Reagan, I think, innately understood the old line about the Soviets, that the Soviet workers pretended to work and the government pretended to pay them.
Yeah, that's right. Reagan's intuition about them turned out to be exactly right and far better than the CIA ever got. The CIA was predicting well into the 80s, overestimating the Soviet economy. And in fact, I tell the story that's been told before, but I think it's worth repeating again, that as late as 1986, the CIA put out their annual report on the world, in which they said that real per capita income in East Germany was higher than real per capita income in West Germany. Well, this is so laughably preposterous that you can't believe that taxpayers have to pay money for something so stupid. I think it was Pat Moynihan who said any taxi driver in West Berlin can tell you that was nonsense. But, of course, as I like to say about the CIA, they don't hire any taxi drivers in West Berlin. They hire graduates of Harvard and Princeton and Yale who think it was perfectly plausible for a command economy to do just as well as West Germany. It turned out after the Berlin Wall came down and we got into the East German intelligence archives, we found out that they were so alarmed at the poor quality of U.S. intelligence about East Germany that they were actually afraid that we didn't take them seriously. You know, well, who we shouldn't take seriously was the CIA. Well, Reagan knew better about all of those things.
So what lessons from Reagan's victory over the Soviet Union can and should be applied to our current war with, however you want to term it, radical Islam, war on terror?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that comes to mind is, we're all watching Obama, who some political observers and some liberals like to say is the liberal Reagan, and I think he's not for a whole lot of reasons. But one of them is, early on in the campaign, Obama said, well, I'd like to sit down and talk with the Iranians. After all, Ronald Reagan talked to the Soviets. And he got in some trouble because he said he would do it without preconditions. Well, again, the Reagan experience is, yeah, he sat down and talked with the Soviet Union, but he had several preconditions that were quite important and that, in fact, set the ground for him to win those negotiations. Essentially, he had four. Most of our summits with the Soviet Union before Reagan had been about arms control and maybe some cultural stuff and whatnot. Reagan said, and the Soviet Union agreed, I'm not going to sit down with you unless we're going to talk about four things. Arms control, human rights, which the Soviet Union didn't want to talk about, and Reagan insisted. The third thing was regional conflicts, which meant the Soviet Union mucking around in Afghanistan and Central America and elsewhere. And then the fourth one was cultural exchanges, which was the easier part. But the point is by saying that we are going to talk about all four of those things at summits, and that put the Soviet Union immediately on the defensive. So, whether we can talk to Iran or not is I don't know. However, if we're going to do it, it seems to me that you ought to have those kind of preconditions. Iran, we're going to talk to you about your nuclear program. We're going to talk to you about human rights in your country. And we're going to talk to you about your support of terrorism around the world. And my guess is that I don't think Iran wants to talk to us at all, but I think they would reject those terms. But that would be the lesson from Reagan that you would take if you really were trying to emulate his example.
Reagan was considered by the liberal media kind of an intellectual lightweight.
Right.
Did you find out in looking at letters, speeches, commentaries?
Well, this is an interesting part of Reagan that is a little bit hard to make out. Not entirely. I think I understand the reasons for it, but they take a while to explain. But, Reagan, we know, was very disciplined and a very hard worker. And he often concealed all this for some good reasons. He told somebody one time that he wanted the American people to get the feeling their president was in control of things and that he wasn't overburdened by the office the way Jimmy Carter always gave off the impression, or Lyndon Johnson. So Reagan never wanted to be photographed going up to his living quarters, for example, in the evening, carrying three notebooks of documents he was going to get through that night. We know he did that kind of thing. And instead, he would make those jokes about how they say hard work never killed anyone, but I say, why take chances? Well, that was all artifice on his part. We now know and have known for about 10 years now of his extensive writings, thousands of letters, the radio addresses in the 70s. I think I added up the radio addresses one time, and it was something like 400,000 words or some enormous output, equivalent of 800-page books. That was a real eye-opener for everybody, for Reagan's friends and his critics alike, that in fact this guy was much more in command and control of things than people thought. And in fact, some of the older listeners may remember there's a famous Saturday Night Live sketch, I think from back in the 80s, early 90s, with Phil Hartman. And he plays the Reagan that we know of, the kindly old man patting the Girl Scouts on the head. And then when they leave, he closes the door and he becomes this Machiavellian schemer, rolling out a map and barking out orders about how the world's going to be run. Well, it turns out the comics were much closer to reality than we thought, as sometimes is the case with comedy and satire. So these are the things that we came to realize about Reagan only subsequently. And even, by the way, some of his own people who worked for him didn't really perceive this about him.
What lessons should today's Republicans and conservatives learn from Reagan? Is it the same lesson or different lesson for conservatives and Republicans?
Well, I think there's a shrewdness about the guy that's a complicated story, but there's one that I particularly seize upon. You know, we all remember Reagan as the great communicator and for giving these wonderful speeches and for his vision and so forth. But, of course, what we know, as I just suggested a minute ago, is that didn't come naturally. I mean, he was a talented man, but just like, say, Michael Jordan or a great athlete who works very hard to get that good, Reagan worked very, very, very hard on understanding the issues and on writing his speeches and delivering them. And, you know, one of my main criticisms of politicians these days across the political spectrum is that they're kind of slapdash about their speech making. They don't prepare very hard. They don't work on the speeches very long. They ramble too much. You know, Reagan understood from his show business days a simple principle, which was always leave your audience wanting more. And that's why if you go back and compare, a lot of his speeches are much shorter in comparison to speeches that presidents and senators and governors make today. And I think that that's one of the things that worked for him so well. So, you know, people who say they want to follow Reagan's examples ought to study much more carefully the man's self-discipline in the way he, you know, decided to communicate, because it was quite a deliberate product and not something that was just something he just did easily when he rolled out of bed in the morning.
Well, Reagan attracted many Democrats to his side, primarily those who were more hawkish on national security and defense issues.
Right.
Was that something that was deliberate on his part, or was that caused by divisions within the Democratic Party?
Well, both. I mean, Reagan, you know, a lot of the sort of old liberal cold warriors, people like Gene Kirkpatrick, Max Kampelman, an important name that's now kind of forgotten, you know, they were breaking with their own party. And, you know, Reagan, in the case of Gene Kirkpatrick, had read one of her articles and said, boy, I really like this person. And Reagan reached out first to her. In another case, Max Kampelman, who'd been a prominent Democrat, Kampelman would have been Hubert Humphrey's Secretary of State if Humphrey'd won the election in 1968. In 1979, Kampelman wrote to Reagan and said, you know, I think I'm on your side on this arms control SALT II business. And so Reagan reached out to Kampelman, who was then still working for Jimmy Carter, and said, you know, if I'm elected president, I want you to stay on with me, which Kampelman did. So there were quite a lot of former Democrats or people who still were Democrats who were in his administration and foreign policy posts. And to that extent, Reagan's presidency represented a coalition government. So here again is another mistake of Obama's. Obama is carrying on some of President Bush's policies in the war on terror, although he gives them a different name and explains them differently. But if he really wanted to have bipartisan foreign policy, he should actually keep some of the same people around or at least consult them for their advice.
So Reagan, being as committed a conservative as he was, why didn't he succeed more in reducing the size and influence of the federal government in domestic affairs?
Yeah, I talk about that quite a bit at the end of my book. The way I put it in speeches recently is the Soviet Union was nothing compared to the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, I'm serious about that. That turned out to be an easier foe. The problem of big government is a harder problem. And it would take a long time to go through it. In fact, I think I may write my next book on that particular problem. But one of the reasons, and only one of them, is that it was the partisan design of liberalism for almost 100 years to expand the government and to make it permanent and hard to roll back. And Reagan rolled a few things back, but in a lot of other cases, he just simply never had the votes on Capitol Hill because a lot of things require changes in statutes. And, you know, you couldn't even get enough Republicans to go along with that. You know, Reagan wanted to abolish the Department of Education. You know, great idea. And there were many Republican senators who said, no, we're never going to go along with that idea. So he didn't have enough support that he would need to have to do that. You know, the president can't do everything that needs to be done, even in two terms. And I quote Mitch Daniels, now the governor of Indiana, who worked for Reagan in the Reagan White House, saying that nothing is clearer than that the damage of a century cannot be undone in one administration. And that's the most important thing going forward that conservatives need to think about, I think.
So in your research, what most surprised you about Reagan? What some information that those of us who followed Reagan would be surprised to learn about him?
Well, I think there were two surprises, mostly that come from his diaries. One is how often, and it just fits with the point I was just making, how often Reagan complained about Republicans in his diaries not giving him enough support on Capitol Hill, and I give a lot of examples of that. And he often, you know, were writing his diaries about Republicans who joined Democrats in overriding a veto of a big spending bill, or who deserted him on a vote he needed on some statutory change, and he'd say, "We had rabbits when we needed tigers." And some individual Republicans he called out by name in his diary. My favorite was Lowell Weicker, the liberal Republican from Connecticut, who he called a no-good, pompous fathead. I kind of like that one. The other surprise, I guess, is it's not sort of a revelation, but it's clear from his diaries and from some other documents that he really pushed the Iran arms for hostages transactions quite longer than they should have gone on, out of his deep sympathy and sentimentality for the plight of the hostages being held by Hezbollah in Lebanon. That's entirely understandable on human terms, but it was bad policy, and you know, it almost led to the undoing of his presidency.
Well, one of the things about that that I think is misunderstood, and I'm not sure how you look at it, is that, in fact, Reagan didn't think he was trading arms for hostages with the Iranian government of Khomeini, but he thought he was dealing with moderate forces in the government that perhaps would turn on the Khomeini regime. Isn't that right?
Well, there's an aspect of that. Yeah, I mean, that was a reasonable point, but it got very muddled and confused. I mean, you know, there was that point that was valid. On the other hand, he was also, for example, asking the Prime Minister of Japan, we later learned, because Japan had lots of trade relations with Iran, asked the Prime Minister of Japan if he could intercede with Iran to see if Iran could get the hostages released. So, yeah, I mean, Reagan had this sort of two steps removed idea that, well, I'm not dealing directly with Hezbollah, which, you know, for him was sort of a firewall. But I think it backfired on him. You take the rough with the smooth, as Churchill used to say, and you know, it's part of the same sentimentality, rightly understood, or the best kind, that made him such a patriotic man, that also, I think, led him to, you know, distort policy because of his sympathy for the plight of the hostages. It was a sad affair all around. I think he knew it didn't work later on. But as I say, no one's perfect, and it certainly does not diminish him as a great statesman in any respect, in my mind.
We just have a couple minutes left here, Stephen, and I'd like to ask you about another book you did, The Real Jimmy Carter.
Right.
I know we're not going to be able to get deeply into it, but just, I mean, your subtitle alone, How Our Worst Ex-President Undermines American Foreign Policy, Coddles Dictators, and Created the Party of Clinton and Kerry.
Right.
Tells a lot, but just give us like one story about Carter, and then we're going to have to wrap it up here.
Yeah. Well, I wrote that book way back in 2003, 2004, after Carter won the Nobel Peace Prize. I just couldn't stand it anymore when that happened. I think he's an egregious figure. The one story I make a big deal about is how in 1991, in the run-up to the first Gulf War, Carter was actively and privately contacting heads of government in the Middle East and elsewhere, saying you should not support President Bush in Operation Desert Storm. And you know, and Bush didn't know about this. I mean, they were shocked when they found out. I mean, we only have one president at a time, and Carter seemed to think it was still him. It was absolutely unbelievable that an ex-president would interfere with the current president's foreign policy like that. And, you know, that ought to be a scandal, and he never got called to account for that.
I think another bit of a scandal is where all the money came from that he started up the Carter Center with. And to tell us what you know about that.
Well, you know, some of that, a fair bit of that is publicly available, and, you know, from an awful lot of Arab sources in the Middle East. So I actually think Carter's anti-Semitism, I mean, I'll just say it straight out, he doesn't like Jews, and he doesn't like Israel, and he's openly on the side of the Palestinians. So some of that money, I think he actually believes those views, but it made very, excuse me, convenient and easy for Arab sources of money to direct money to his cause.
So, Stephen, tell us where people can get your books and how they can read your material, and just let's wrap it up with that.
Right. Well, the book should be, the new one, The Age of Reagan, The Conservative Counter-Revolution, should be in, you know, most fine bookstores everywhere, as the old saying goes.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon.com, of course, is the easiest way. Saves you a trip in your car to a bookstore. And then, you know, I don't have my own website, but I do have, you know, all my articles that I write are available on the AEI website. If you go on AEI.org and do a search for my name, up will pop my page with links to everything I write here, there, and everywhere.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, listen, we want to thank you so much for being with us. It's been very enlightening, and I urge everyone to go out and get both of those books, or all three of them, the two Reagan books and the Carter book. And, Stephen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
You bet. So, Don, this, I think a lot of interesting information came out today, and we'll be back next week. We've got some... we've got Congressman Mike Rogers coming up to talk about health care. And we have Kirk Lipple, the commander of the Cole, the USS Cole, and some comments he has to make about situation Guantanamo and with some of the policy on detaining former terrorists. But that's going to have to be it for today. Thank you for joining us on Take AIM, and we will be back next week. So long.